Well, good evening, everybody. It's good to be here with you. And I appreciate this church and just the work that you're doing here in this place, and also just the support and encouragement that you give to so many in different places. And I just want to say right at the outset that I've definitely gained that perspective of this church and the work that we're doing now in San Francisco. And so, as big of a change as that has been, and as intimidating as you might expect that to be, it's been really helpful and really encouraging to know that there's a group here that is not only supporting us financially, but also praying for us and thinking about us and encouraging us in so many ways. We really appreciate all of your help with that. Getting to the end of month two in San Francisco, and so I feel like we have maybe started to finish settling into, you know, the changes. And as many changes as there are and as many adjustments as there are that need to be made, we've gotten some good things going. And so you can look for our second report coming out here in the next couple of weeks. But thankful to know that you're supporting us in all of that. And I'm also just really thankful for the series that you have chosen to do here. Going through the different stages of life, I think, is very wise and a very worthwhile study. So we've come this evening to talk about the stage of being married or newly married. And I'm not sure really what the difference is between being newly married and being oldly married, because I've only experienced the newly married part. But coming up here on 5 years of marriage for me next month, I feel like I've gotten a little bit of a perspective on it, but at the same time feel totally unqualified to be able to, like, tell all of you how it ought to be done. And so I guess it's in times like this that I'm just really thankful that it's not about my wisdom or my insight or my ability, but that my responsibility is simply to just say, well, here's some things God has said. And so I hope that our time here together will be well spent, not because I'm some wedding guru and know all the ins and outs of relationships, but just so that we can consider what God has said together and see what kind of guidance that He might have for us. I will say, though, that in my 26 years, that I've gone through a few changes in life, gone through a few different phases. You know, turning 16 and getting a driver's license is a pretty big change in my life. Graduating from high school, moving out of the house, going to college, that's a pretty big change. And then, you know, just less than, a little over a year ago, a big change was having a child and becoming a father. And so that's a pretty big shift. But I will say that I think that in all of the different phases that I've experienced, all of the different changes or shifts, I think that marriage might be the most significant change that a person can experience in life. And I say that because when you get married, it not only changes your habits, it not only changes, like, your lifestyle and your routines, but it fundamentally changes your identity. And I think that's what Jesus was talking about in Matthew chapter 19, if you want to turn there. We'll read a few verses here in Matthew 19 where Jesus quotes from Genesis chapter 2. But, you know, I think this is the difference because, you know, when I got my driver's license, it changed some of my habits. Like, I turned the radio up a little bit louder than I was used to turning it up in the car because I could, because I was by myself. And then, like, when I went to college, I started staying up a lot later and just hanging out and because I could, because I didn't have any expectations from parents about when to be home or what my bedtime was. But when I got married, not only did my habits change, not only did my lifestyle change, but there's a fundamental change in identity that happens. And let's look at this. In Matthew 19 and verse 4, Jesus answers this question about divorce, and he says, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate." And so Jesus quotes this passage from Genesis chapter 2 that explains what God's vision of marriage is all about and what kind of changes that He expects to take place. And I think that there are just profound implications of this. And we could talk all night about what this means to be in a one flesh or a one person relationship. But I think that fundamentally what it comes down to is just that there's this entire shift where it's no longer about two people's lives or two people's paths or two people's careers or two people's hopes. But all of that just sort of gets pushed together and not only bound together but remade and reformed into something new entirely. And so because of that, whatever hurts one person in this relationship hurts the both of you. Whatever helps one person in this relationship helps the both of you, because you're no longer two, but you're one. And so you can't affect one person without affecting the other person. I think that's part of what's tied up in this idea of the two becoming one. I think that when we understand that, we realize that helping or hurting our spouse is ultimately just something that helps or hurts ourselves. Now, I don't want us to get like too turned around on this and think about it backwards, because you can start to think, well, okay, it's actually just sort of a selfish thing that I should want to help my wife or help my husband, because if I'm helping him or her, then I'm actually just helping myself. And what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 29 is, he says, no one ever hated his own flesh. It's not like the Bible is telling us, hey, you need to be careful that you don't hurt your own flesh. You need to be careful that you don't hurt yourself. The Bible just takes for granted the fact that nobody ever does. And I realize that there are people with mental illnesses and things like that who do. But the point is like when you fall, you're going to put your hands out to try to stop yourself. Generally speaking, that's the way that works. And so, this idea of the two becoming one, I think what it's doing for us is it's changing our whole perspective. That it becomes, and it should become, instinctual. It should become natural. It should become something that we are just compelled to do, to help and to protect and to take care of our spouse, because they're a part of us. But I think a second thing that marriage does is that it's also incredibly revealing. And that's also tied up in this idea of the two becoming one. You know, Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount not to let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. But, you know, if you really think about that, you can't actually do that, right? Like, you can't actually keep your left hand's actions a secret from your right hand's. And so, when the two become one, I think that this is an incredibly revealing process for all of us, because we are exposed and become exposed to our spouse, and they're able to see and know pretty much everything about us. You know, I don't know how long the honeymoon phase, quote unquote, is supposed to last, but, you know, it's not too long into marriage where your spouse begins to see some of your less flattering sides. Maybe it's just like they see, they see you before you get a shower and get dressed in the morning, and it's just like, wow, I didn't know I was getting into all that. But, you know, there are moments that happen throughout life where you just see each other at your worst. You see each other under stress. You see each other when you're angry. You see each other when you're tempted. And because you spend all this time around each other and you're really one flesh now, there's really no room for any other secrets. I'll say that that's not always a pleasant experience, though, to find out some things about yourself that you might not have been aware of. In my 5 years of marriage, I've learned a lot about myself, and not all of it's been good. And I'm still learning things about myself. And I think that what happens is that we begin to see ourselves from the other person's perspective. And that's also an idea that's tied up in this two becoming one. Is that you begin to not only see yourself from your own perspective, but you begin to become more aware of how my habits impact somebody else. How what I say has an effect on somebody else. And not only what I say, but how I say what I say, the tone that I use, how that can be either a positive or a negative thing. And so the topic that I've been given tonight is the idea of honoring one another. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that that idea of a husband honoring a wife and a wife honoring her husband and the two honoring each other, it only makes sense when we understand this two becoming one perspective. It only makes sense when we realize, okay, that whatever I do, whatever impact I have on my husband or wife is really going to help or hurt me. And when we're able to see ourselves from the other person's perspective. And so when those two things happen, when our minds start to shift and we begin to accept and understand this teaching that Jesus gives and that Jesus reiterates from Genesis, that the two become one, that's when we can really start to see why honoring each other is so important and why this is such a crucial thing. And so the lesson that I have for you is really very simple. I want to talk about what, I want to talk about why, and I want to talk about how. So what it means to honor each other, why we should honor each other, and make it practical and talk about some ways that maybe how we could do that. And so to talk about, well, what does it mean to actually honor each other? When I think about honoring in a general sense, to honor something basically means that you exalt it. It means that you lift it up, you put it in a special place, or you treat it in a special way. Some of you might have like art or decorations or silverware or china cabinets or whatever, but you understand that there are some things that are worth honoring, and so you treat them in a special way. You protect them. You think that they're valuable. And really, I think that's the core of what it means to honor something. It's this idea of valuing it. It's of saying, this is special, this is important, this is valuable, this means something to me. Whatever it is, whether it's a person or just some object, what you're saying when you honor it is, this is worthy of special treatment. Let me show you an example in Scripture that uses this word honoring this way. Look in Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13 and in verse 7. It says, pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. And so this idea in Romans chapter 13 is, or Romans, where was I? Yeah, Romans 13, verse 7, is that honor is something that is deserved by some. That some people are owed a certain amount of honor, and that really what you're doing is you're recognizing this idea that there is honor that belongs to this person because of who they are. But even more than that, I think that what the Bible teaches us about honoring people is that it's not always just about honoring people to whom honor is owed, or people who seem like they deserve honor, but that it's actually our responsibility to choose to honor people. It's our responsibility to place value and to treat people as valuable, not just because they deserve it, but because of a choice that we make. And I'll show you an example of that too. Look in 1 Timothy chapter 6. 1 Timothy chapter 6. And in verse 1, it says, let all who are under a yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and the teaching may not be reviled. Okay, so what we saw in Romans chapter 13 is that we should give honor to people who deserve honor. That's just sort of the thing that is expected of us. But what Paul says to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 1 is, this is something that all bondservants should do. Verse 1 begins by saying, let all who are under a yoke as bondservants. And so, I guess the question is do you think that every single master was actually worthy of honor? No. I mean, there would be masters that would be cruel or mean or would mistreat the people that work for them. And yet what Paul tells Timothy is, let all of those people who are under yoke as bondservants regard their own masters as worthy of all honor. This is a choice that you make. This is a deliberate action that you take, that I will treat these people with honor, not based on whether or not they deserve it, but because this is a deliberate action that I'm taking. And so when we see this idea of honoring people in Scripture, we see that it's both, that there are some people who deserve honor, but then there are some people that we have a responsibility to show honor to or to regard as honorable. And that's a decision and a choice that we make. So when we begin to talk about what it means to honor one another, I tried to look up where that lesson title came from. And unless I'm missing it, I couldn't find a scripture that says that exactly, honor one another. But I think that there are two places in Scripture that this idea comes from, and I want us to look at both of those. First, let's look in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. I really like this idea, beginning in verse 9, about how we ought to treat one another. It says, Romans 12 and verse 9, let love be genuine. Abhor what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. Love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. I think really that verse 9 is giving us sort of like the thesis for all of these things. Now, obviously in this passage, he's talking more broadly than just in the marriage relationship. But if these are the principles that should guide the way that we treat our brethren, then how much more should they be the principles that guide how we treat our spouse? But verse 9, like I said, I think is the thesis where he says, let love be genuine. Let love be genuine. Isn't that what any of us have ever wanted from anybody? Is real love? You know, don't just tell me that you love me. Don't just, like, pretend that you love me. Don't just make a show out of it. Don't tell other people that you love me. I want you to love me for real. And I think that's what Paul's saying here, is that your relationships with your brethren should be guided by real love. Don't just show up and say you love each other. Act like it. Treat each other like you love each other. And again, if that's true in our relationships with our brothers and sisters, if that's true with just other Christians, how much more should that be true in marriage? And so all of these things would be things that would describe what real love, what authentic love does, what it's all about. First of all, abhor what is evil. You know, if I love somebody, then I'm not going to want anything bad for them. I'm going to hate that. He says, hold fast to what is good. There's this idea of perseverance. There's this idea of patience. That if I love somebody, then I'm going to endure. I'm not going to just quit as soon as it's difficult. I'm not just going to throw my hands up. But real love has this idea of steadfastness. But then verse 10 is really where we ought to focus in on for the context of this lesson. And he says, love one another with brotherly affection. Outdo one another in showing honor. So there's our idea in verse 10 of honoring one another. First of all, can I just say this? Every now and then I hear somebody say, well, the Bible tells me that I have to love you, but I don't have to like you. You ever heard that before? That comes up when people are having problems with relationships in the church, and it's like, okay, I don't have to love that person, but I don't have to like them. I think there's some people who live their marriages that way. Who think, okay, I have to love you, but I don't have to like you. And verse 10 just sort of blows that out of the water, doesn't it? I mean, the ideal is that there is both affection and there is love that come together. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't treat somebody lovingly that you don't really like that much. Like, whether you like somebody, whether you're affectionate towards somebody or not, the responsibility is to treat them in a loving way. But I think that we would all agree that according to the biblical wisdom, in verse 10, the ideal is that love and affection are together. Like, that would be the gold standard. That would be the greatest thing that could happen.
And again, if that's true in relationships with our brethren, that ought to be true in our marriages. Well, the question comes, well, how do we have that? You know, how do we develop relationships? How do we develop marriages that are guided both by love and affection? Where we're willing to work and we're willing to sacrifice and we're willing to act out love, but there's also a warmth and an affection that is behind it. How do we actually do that? And I think that it's in this last phrase, outdo one another in showing honor. I've always really liked that idea. I don't know if it's just because I'm naturally a competitive person, but I always like to compete with other people. I mean, it doesn't matter what the game is, if it's tic-tac-toe or horseshoes or, you know, anything, I want to win. I want to be better than you at that. Like, that's just the way I'm wired. How often have you seen somebody be competitive about honoring people? How often have you seen a relationship where you've got two people that are competing to show each other more love, to show each other more honor? You know, it's like you run into somebody at the door and you're fighting over who's going to hold the door for the other person. Like, that's sort of the picture that I get from this kind of thing. You know, normally when we talk about competitive people, normally when we talk about people who are trying to outdo one another, it's for some sort of personal gain. And that causes tension, that causes animosity, that causes some kind of, like, contrast between the two people. But imagine if you had a church full of people that were all just, like, trying to outdo each other in honor. Where as soon as a task needed to be done, like, people were, like, fighting to sign up on the list to be the first person to get it done. Or as soon as, like, the building needed to be cleaned, or there was some kind of, like, task that needed to be done, people were just really eager to do that. That would be a really wonderful church to be a part of. Imagine what a marriage like that would be like. That as soon as something needs to get done, that both of you are fighting for and trying to outdo the other person in being the one who does it. That would be a really amazing relationship. And I think that's what Paul is describing here in this phrase of outdoing one another and showing honor. And so it's this idea of saying what you want is more important than what I want. What you need is more important than what I need. That I'm going to try to swoop in and give you what you want before you can swoop in and give me what I want. And that would just be an amazing relationship. The other place that this idea of honoring one another in marriage comes up is in 1 Peter chapter 3. And I want us to turn there. 1 Peter chapter 3. We'll begin reading in verse 1. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold jewelry or the clothing you wear, but let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. For this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. Likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you of the grace of life, so that your prayers may not be hindered. So, certainly in this text, I think that there is this idea of a mutual honoring that God expects for us to have in marriage. Where you see the honoring of the wife to the husband by submitting to him and even calling him Lord. And I'll let you work out what that means in your relationships. But then there's also this idea of the husband honoring the wife. And it says explicitly in verse 7, showing honor to the woman as the weaker vessel. Now, we talked about how showing honor or placing value on something, it really has two ideas. That there is recognizing those who deserve honor. And then there's also choosing to honor regardless of what somebody deserves. And I think that both of those ideas are actually brought out in verse 7. So if you ask, okay, husband, why should you honor your wife? Well, one answer is because she deserves it. Because she is an heir with you of the grace of life. And so this great idea is this, is that, like, look, if my wife is a child of God, if my wife is somebody that God has loved, and if my wife is somebody that God has sacrificed for, who God has felt pain for because He loves her, how can I treat her with any less than that?
So she deserves it.
But then there's also this other idea of, well, I should honor my wife because I'm choosing to. Not because, like, her behavior necessarily makes me think that she deserves it, but because I have a responsibility to choose to honor her as well. And I think that's brought up in this idea of, he says, live with your wife in an understanding way. Now notice that Peter doesn't tell us husbands, understand your wife. Did you notice that? That might be impossible sometimes. You know, like, we just think differently, we approach things differently sometimes, men and women, husbands and wives. Like, Peter's not saying you will always understand why your wife feels the way she feels. But he says, even if you don't understand it, live with her in an understanding way. And so, honoring her, putting her needs above my needs, putting her desires above my desires, means that I have to live with her in an understanding way, even if I don't understand her. Because she's worth honoring because of what God has done for her. But it's a choice and it's a decision that I have to make. And so that really gets us into the why. We've talked about how to honor, or we've talked about what it means to honor each other. But that gets us into the why. Why is this something that's important for us? And it's not a complicated answer. This isn't like the calculus of the Bible. This is basic math. It's just the reason why we should honor each other is because God has honored us. I mean, that is the foundational message of the gospel, is that God has treated us in ways that are loving and sacrificial and undeserved, and He's gone above and beyond what any of us could have deserved. And that grace that God has shown to us should directly impact the way that we treat everybody. And if it impacts the way we treat everybody, certainly it should impact the way that we treat our husbands or our wives. You know, we looked at Romans chapter 12 and saw that phrase, outdo one another in showing honor. You remember how Romans 12 and verse 1 starts. When Paul says, okay, look, I've got these things that I want to share with you, and I've got these things that I want to encourage you to do. He says, I appeal to you, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable, which is your spiritual worship. And then he goes on to say those things that we've been talking about. See, like, that was Paul's answer. If anybody ever said, hey, Paul, why should I outdo one another in showing honor? Why should that be something that I do? He says, remember, I told you, I'm appealing to you by the mercies of God. God has shown you mercy. You have to show mercy. Let me look at another passage with you in Romans. Look at Romans chapter 5. Romans chapter 5 and verse 6. It says, for while we were still weak, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows His love for us, in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And so that's the example, that's the pattern, that is the demonstration of what real love and real honor is all about. And I think God shows us both sides here. He, first of all, shows us the value of our souls, that He said, okay, you are worth sending my Son to die for, you are worth me going through pain for, you are worth me sacrificing for, but at the same time, He did it when we were most unworthy and most undeserving. You know, I've got news for all of us. God didn't look down at me and see me and my sin and my weakness and my just selfishness and say, man, that Josh Carter, I got to have that one. And let me try to cater to him, and let me try to like woo him and bring him in. No. We were, as Ephesians tells us, dead in our trespasses and sins in which we once walked. There was nothing appealing about us. There was nothing lovable about us. There was nothing about us that would cause God to say, okay, you are worthy. You are deserving of this honor and this love. But he loved us anyway. And what the New Testament does for us is it says, okay, if you are somebody that has received that grace, if you're somebody that has received that mercy in your life, how can you treat anybody else with anything less than that? Once we realize that God has shown us honor even when we didn't deserve it, then how am I going to look at my wife and say, you're not acting in a way that deserves honor today? It means that the gospel hasn't impacted me the way it ought to. Let me show you the same idea in Colossians chapter 3. I think Colossians chapter 3 is another passage, like the ones that we've been looking at, that gives us a lot of really good advice about how to treat our brethren. And the point that I've made a couple of times is, if this is good advice about how to treat our brethren, then certainly it's good advice about how to treat our husbands and wives. But look at Colossians 3 beginning in verse 12. Put on, then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, humility, meekness, and patience, bearing with one another, and if one has a complaint against another, forgiving each other. Just stop there for a second. I'm going to ask you to do the same thing that I've asked you to do a couple of times already, but imagine a church where everybody does these things. Imagine a marriage where both people have these qualities. How amazing would that be? How blessed would that be? If we were compassionate and kind and humble and meek and patient. God's wisdom is leading us to have happy and fulfilling relationships if we'll just accept it and we'll be guided by it. But, you know, you might read through that list and say, well, why should I be like that? Why should I be so humble and meek and patient? And why should I forgive my spouse if they've done something wrong? Well, there it is in verse 13. As the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive. You see, I think that when we don't honor each other, the problem is that we are not as appreciative of the honor God has shown to us as we ought to be. And the Bible is really presenting it this way, is, okay, look, this is what it means to honor each other, but the reason why this is so crucial for you is because of the honor that God has shown. We don't have time to turn to Ephesians chapter 5, and it seems kind of sad because it's like, can you talk about marriage and not turn to Ephesians chapter 5? But I would encourage you to look at Ephesians 5 on your own time, and I'm sure that you've studied that before. But in Ephesians 5, it talks about how the husband is meant to be the leader of his family and of his wife. And the wife is meant to submit to him, and that there should be love and sacrifice tied up. And as Paul begins to sort of lay that out, he says, now, this is a great mystery, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. And so in Ephesians 5, when we see how marriage is supposed to function and how a husband is supposed to lead his wife and the wife is supposed to submit to her husband, that it's almost impossible to parse out what parts are talking about marriage and what parts are talking about Christ and the church. And I think that even that's indicative of the way the gospel is meant to impact us. Is that you can't talk about what God has done for us and not have some understanding or some application of what that implicates for how we ought to treat each other. And so, when we talk about the husband being the leader, I think that what we learn from God's love for us is that that's fundamentally about sacrifice. Is that Christ is the head of the church, but he didn't just do what he did for his own personal benefit. He sacrificed for the benefit of the church. when we talk about the wife being submissive to her husband, that again, that is fundamentally about sacrifice. And really, that is the idea of what honoring each other is about. Is again, we're saying, I am choosing to put your wants above my wants. I'm choosing to put your needs above my needs. That's true whether you're the husband or the wife in the relationship. Now, one thing I think is important to notice about this is something that God expects for us to do whether or not our husband or wife reciprocates it. You know, it's never been a valid excuse to say, like, well, I'm not going to do what I need to do because they're not doing what they need to do. But I think that what you would agree with me about is that this relationship really only functions properly. It only works best when both sides are committed to it. It can put incredible strain on a relationship when just one person wants to sacrifice, but it's when both sides are sacrificing. It's when both sides are trying to outdo one another in showing honor. That's when the beauty of this wisdom really shines. I want to turn with you to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And I think that this illustrates this principle as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 in verse 3. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. The thing I want you to notice in this text is that when Paul begins to describe this relationship between the husband and the wife, notice how many times Paul talks about giving. And notice what's totally absent in this discussion is the word taking. You know, a lot of times I think that we approach relationships like there's some kind of like business deal, where it's like, I want to know what I can get out of it. I want to know what I can gain from it. And that's not at all the relationship that Paul describes here for marriage. That really primarily the emphasis should be on what can I give? What can I sacrifice? How can I cause the other person to get what they need? And not how can I just take what I think that I need? I think there's profound implications in this. I realize that Paul is talking very specifically about the physical relationship between a husband and wife. But I think that there's implications for this that touch every part of life. And again, it goes back to this idea that the two have become one flesh. And that is that what we need to realize is that we will never truly be pleased, we'll never truly be fulfilled until our spouse is pleased or our spouse is fulfilled. It's easy to like say that in theory, but I think that this is true in the sexual relationship as he's talking about here. It's also true in terms of our lifestyle. It's also true in terms of our self-image, that I may think that if I can get what I want, then I'll be happy. And what God is telling us is no. That until your spouse gets what they need, then you're never going to get what you need. You'll never be fulfilled. And your relationship will never be what it ought to be. So, before I finish, I just want to talk about some specific applications that maybe we can make from all of this. We talked about what honoring each other is, that it's choosing to place value on somebody. We've talked about why we ought to honor each other because God has honored us. But now let's talk about how. What are some specific ways that husbands and wives can show honor to each other? The first thing I have is look for the good in what each other does. Look for the good in what each other does. It's easy, I think, to just see the things that annoy us. It's easy to focus in on the things that, you know, we wish that they would load the bowls on the other rack in the dishwasher, or, you know, like whatever trivial things. But look for the good in what each other does. It's like the song says, to count your many blessings It makes us be more grateful for what God has done for us. Well, if we count the blessings that our husbands and wives give to us, then it'll make us more grateful for them. A second application would be, go out of your way to help each other. That when you see that there's something that your spouse is needing to do or having to do, like, why don't you just go ahead and make their load a little bit easier? Whether that's helping out with chores around the house, or whether that is having a conversation with them. When you recognize that they have something that's heavy on them, help bear their load. The third application would be, don't tell yourself bad stories and develop resentment. One thing that's tempting in any relationship is to not only observe what somebody has done, but then to connect the dots and say, I know why they did that. And I think one thing that happens sometimes is we may see something that our husband or wife has done, and not only does it annoy us, but in our mind we think, I know why they did that. They're trying to get back at me for this, or their motive was that. And we just don't know that. And so don't tell yourself bad stories about your spouse. A fourth application I have is, be willing to apologize. You know, isn't that one of the easiest things to avoid doing? Is when you've had some kind of a disagreement, when you realize that maybe you haven't spoken with the right tone or in the most loving way or made the most wise decision, it's easy to just kind of like go off to your own corner. And it's like the two boxers go back to their corners, and it's the stalemate and the standoff for who's going to apologize first. I think if we're really honoring each other and putting each other's needs and desires above our own needs and desires, then we're going to be the first person that goes across and says, you know what? What I did was wrong. Whether or not they did everything correct themselves, if we have something to apologize for, we're the first to make that move. Another application would be to make your spouse feel valued both in public and in private. One thing that I've learned very quickly is that wives can be very sensitive to not only what you say about them, but how that might make them be perceived. And I can tell you husbands are the same way. Is that if we do not feel valued by our spouse, then it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks of us. We just don't feel valued. And then finally, just very simply, don't stop talking. Don't stop listening. And what I mean by all of these applications is not just to give you some like vague, just random advice about marriage, but I think that all of these things are ways that we honor each other. All of these are ways that we say, what you think matters to me. What you feel is important to me. And that's why we ought to do all of these things. The last point that I have for you, just by way of conclusion, is this. The note that I want to end on is that you can only properly honor one another when you're properly honoring God. I think that's a principle that all of us need to make sure that we understand. Jesus talked about that in a couple of different places. In Matthew chapter 10, he talked about how, you know, if you love your father or mother more than me, you're not worthy of me. And it was in Luke chapter 14 and verse 26, where Jesus specifically says, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And so, I think that what is being taught to us here is that it's important for us to have our loves in order. And the Bible is telling us this, is that for any of this to work properly, you have to love God first. Love him with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And then, the second thing on that list must be your spouse. And then after that, you should probably love your career to a certain extent. And then after that, you should maybe love some hobbies, but you can't get those things out of order, right? If you love your hobbies more than you love your job, then you're not going to show up for work and you're going to get fired, right? If you love your job more than you love your spouse, well, then that's going to cause problems too, because then you're going to be neglecting him or neglecting her. But just as much as that's true, it's important that we love God first. And the reason why is this. Because if I love, or if I'm trying to honor my spouse before I love and honor God, then really what that does is it places unrealistic expectations on my spouse. I'm trying to ask her to be something that she's not equipped to be. I'm trying to find fulfillment and joy and ultimate satisfaction and security in her. But when I find all of those things in God first, well, then that frees me to love her sacrificially. When I decide that everything that I have is for His glory, when I sacrifice all that I have for His purposes, then I don't have anything to hold back for myself. And I can give up whatever it might be for her sake, because I've already decided to sacrifice it. So when I'm dedicated to giving God all the honor He deserves, when everything I do is for His glory, when I find my ultimate joy and fulfillment in Him, I'm willing to sacrifice everything I have for Him. I'm not holding on to anything for myself, and it's only then that I can truly honor my wife the way I ought to. It's only then that I can be free to love and sacrifice without holding anything back. So that's the lesson that I have for you tonight. Honoring one another is important. Throughout Scripture, we see that that is the expectation, that if the gospel has affected us the way that it ought to, it will affect and impact every other relationship that we have. And if it impacts all the relationships we have, how much more ought it to impact the marriage relationship that we have? It's important to realize that I have to honor God first. And once I'm focused on that, then there's nothing in the way of me honoring and sacrificing for my spouse. And so I hope that that is helpful for you, and I hope that that's something that you can think about and maybe even make better applications than I've made tonight. So I'm assuming, do we have an invitation song at the end of this? So the point from Ephesians chapter 5 is that as wonderful as marriage is and as amazing as this relationship is, God has always intended for it to be sort of like a living drama. That each one of us has a marriage that displays to the world what real love is all about. That it mimics the love that Christ has for the church. And so if you're outside of Christ tonight, or if there's something that you need to do to make your life right with God, I would encourage you, in the vein of this lesson, to think about the very best husband that you've ever seen. Think about the way that he put his wife before himself. Think about the way that he was patient and loving and encouraging, the way that he was gentle and sacrificial. And help that to put a face on the Christ who died for you. He is the ultimate husband. His church is the ultimate bride. And if you want to come to him, he can give you a relationship that is more satisfying and more fulfilling than any human relationship. And once you have that, then you'll be equipped to go out into the world and to love as he's loved. If there's anything you need to do to make your life right with God, the invitation is the Lord's. And if you know what you need to do, come to the front and let us know what your needs are while we stand and sing.